Session number 10931.
Mr. Benz, real toe.
Tea, condensed milk, and when the train stopped, two of us would dash up to the engine, place the tin underneath the steam pipe of the engine, and ask the driver to let off some steam. And this made the tea. Dash back to the carriage again and drink the tea. I first of all, I thought, good heavens, this is dreadful. A dirty old engine, we're drinking the water out of it. But then when one realised it was boiled, so it should be safe, and it did us no harm, as it happened. We arrived in Delhi, and we were taken by truck the 40 miles to Meerut. I was rather surprised during the journey to see camels drawing carts along the road. I'd always associated camels with the desert, but of course there are plenty of camels in northern India. We arrived in Meerut, and we were placed into a large Cajun hut, the largest Cajun hut I ever saw during my time out there.
What's a Cajun hut?
A hut made of palm leaves.
K-A-J-I-N?
K-A-D-J-A-N, Cajun, yes, Cajun hut, we always call them. There was also a large house. We were in the grounds of a large house there. I think we arrived there quite late in the day and got into our charpoy, which is an Indian bed. Consists of a wooden frame with just coconut ropes stringed across. This is what we always invariably slept on out east. I was awakened in the morning by a huge Sikh with an enormous beard standing over me, brandishing a razor and a shaving brush and mug. And he wished to shave me. So I declined as politely as I could, because I thought he might cut my throat otherwise. So then we were in Meerut for quite a short time. And then the two parties were split up. Some went to the station at Calcutta, and the others to Colombo and Ceylon. And I was on the Colombo party.
About how many were in your group?
A bit difficult to say. I think by then we were whittled down to perhaps a dozen. Around about a dozen, I would say. I couldn't be too sure about that. So then we commenced the journey south, which was virtually the whole length of India. And it took us nearly a fortnight on the train. 10 days, I think, in fact. Quite interesting, travelling all through the countryside. Especially when we stopped at stations and there were all the little boys with their hands out for backsheesh, or little children, I should say, with their hands out for backsheesh. And also monkeys, who are sometimes difficult to distinguish which were children, which were monkeys, all holding their hands out. We stopped at a station one day, and my friend Gordon Chelwin was sitting with his back to the window, and he felt a hand on his shoulder, and a terrible, terribly scrawny hand handed him a leaflet. And to say it was a leper asking for alms, and he'd be coming back. And rather horrified to look over one's shoulder and see this terrible, scrawny hand. And another time we stopped at a station, we had a large tin of marmalade and I think some bread. And there was a table in the carriage, so we had the marmalade and the bread on the table. But we were all looking out to the platform side to view the scene on the platform. And when we turned round, we found that the marmalade and all the bread had disappeared. We looked out the other side, and there were the monkeys on the line dipping into the marmalade, and we hadn't heard a thing. So then we stopped in Madras for one night, where we were rather surprised to be met by a police van, which took us off to the Salvation Army hostel, where we were put up for the night and had very good food there. And I must say how marvellous the Salvation Army were, wherever one went during the war. I'd like to put that one in. So then we proceeded on our way down to Ceylon.
Seems rather inefficient of SOE to have disembarked you at Bombay, taken you all the way north, and then sent you all the way south.
Yes,
again.
Exactly, yes.
Do you know the reason for
no,
that?
No, I don't. Well, I think Merritt was one of the principal places. Everybody seems to have gone to Merritt that I know, so it must have been quite an important place for SOE, I believe.
But was there anything you did there?
No, we didn't, no, nothing. Didn't do any work there. No, no. And so then we got to the jetty at Danishgodi Tallamanmara.
How do you spell it?
Now you've got me. Where I could look it up for you. The tip of India, where you go from India across to Ceylon, is Danishgodi one side and Tallamanara the other side. And the boat was waiting, and it was monsoon time, it was pelting down with rain, and we boarded this boat, quite a small boat, set off across to Ceylon, and the mountainous seas again, and I remember I could see the Ceylon coast in the distance with just a line of palm trees, and thinking, shall I make it or shan't I? Well, fortunately, I managed to make it all right. And we disembarked and boarded a train which was waiting to take us almost the whole length of Ceylon down to Colombo, and that travelled through the night. We were eaten to death by mosquitoes on the train. And we arrived at Colombo. I think it was 9 a.m. in the morning, and the truck met us to take us to the village of Maharagama, which is about 8 miles outside Colombo, a very small village. And we arrived at the camp, which consisted of two brick huts with tiled roofs, where the other ranks would live, and then there was another for the which was the officers' mess. There was a cookhouse and latrines. That's about all it consisted of, and a high wire fence all the way round. And the front gate was guarded by soldiers of the Ceylon Light Infantry, native soldiers, and. So across the road from where we lived was the transmitter site, which was just a brick hut again, which housed the transmitters, and another brick hut which was the office. And the air, all through that area were the large area, forest of large aerials. We were then put to work, so the receiver site was 3 miles back along the road towards Colombo. And adjacent to the receiver site was the Fanny camp. So we started working shift work. Some men, some Fannies. And we commenced work. We were given a folder with the times of sked. It was called skeds. the time of the sked, the frequency, the call sign to listen for, and all the relevant information, plus the messages, of course. And all the agents we worked to were, they had musical instrument names, such as violin, saxophone, trumpet, horn, and so on. Virtually all of them, I think. So one would be given a folder, say, station horn, and the frequency to listen to. So one would tune the set the frequency, listen for the call sign, and then answer as we'd been taught at Henley, and pass the messages as quickly as possible, of course, because they could be in a dangerous spot and they had to get off the air as quickly as possible. There were also what were called mainline stations. London was always the most busy. We worked to London all night long and received a marvellous signal always from London. It was very easy to work to London. Difficult to work to agents in the field because the signal was always faint and a lot of fading. And I found it was very difficult work because one was always conscious that you had to get them off the air as quickly as possible. And yet if you missed part of the message, you had to ask them to go back and start again at that point. So it was all rather trying.
Did you know where these agents were, or was that...
We had no idea where they were, no idea at all. They could have been in Malaya, they could have been in Thailand, they could have been in Indonesia. You have to realise that everything was so top secret, and it was always emphasised how secret the work was, and one must never ask questions about it, just send the message, receive the message, and pass the message through to the cipher room. So we never knew the contents of the messages that we were sending and receiving, and we didn't know where the agent was, obviously. The only time I can remember was when John Davis and Richard Broom made their first contact by radio. We always kept a listening watch for any agents to come up off sked times if they had an emergency, for instance. And being on the listening watch was rather boring because one just sat there for hours and heard nothing. But I happened to be on the listening watch on one occasion when I suddenly heard the call sign of Broom and Davis. I could hardly believe my ears because nothing had been heard of them for, I believe, about 2.5 years. But the signal was very, very weak, fading in and fading out. I realised it was virtually impossible to take a message. So I called two other operators, one of whom was my friend Harry Cullen, who sadly is now deceased, and one other I can't remember. So the three of us tuned into the signal before I replied. And when we were ready, I made the contact and told them to send the message. The three of us took it down, but we missed so much. I couldn't think it was at all possible to decipher the message. But it was passed through to the cipher room, and I understood that it was deciphered, and the message was requesting medical supplies mostly because they were in such a poor physical condition. That's the only time I can remember knowing, even then I don't think I really knew much about them. I've learned more since, of course.
You were telling me that you had a radio program in recent years in which they thought it was a fanny who'd
Yes.
The message. Can you repeat what
yes,
you told
us? I heard Broome and Davis telling their story on the radio. And when they got to the point where they made the first radio contact, they said a fanny was twiddling the knobs in Colombo and picked up their signal. Well, of course, it could well have been a fanny. I wouldn't like to take anything away from the fannies, because they were absolutely marvellous girls and they worked incredibly well. And it could well have been a fanny, but I just remembered taking the signal. So I thought, well, I'll write to Broome and Davis and see what they have to say. So I wrote and told them how I remembered it, and did they ever establish that it was a fanny. But they both wrote back very nicely and said no, that being a fanny was only hearsay, and they thought it perhaps sounded better for the purpose of the story to be a lady operator.
Did you ever pick anything up from Spencer Chapman?
Well, he was with them at that time, I believe. They all met up at that time. But no, I don't know of any contact. I don't think he had a radio. He was on his own most of the time, wasn't he? Spencer Chapman, I believe. But he met up with Broome and Davis at about that stage. Then going back to the mainline stations, we also worked. I think the next most busy station was Calcutta. We also worked to Kunming in China, and Chungking, and Darwin in Australia. We worked to Cairo for some time, and several other stations in India. Pune, I remember there was one, and Madras. But the busiest stations were London and Calcutta always. So I worked at the radio station there until two or three days after VE Day. And I was then sent to the airfield of Minería, which is in central Ceylon. And at that time, Liberator aircraft were made available to Force 136 for the purpose of the drops in Malaya. They had the range to go to Malaya and back. And to coincide with the arrival of the Liberators at the airfield, I and another friend, Colin Cheatham, were sent to Minería to set up the radio link between the airfield and Colombo. So off we went in a 3-ton truck, and we were accompanied by Sergeant Paddy McGowan, who came to help us settle in. So we arrived at Minería to find that there was a little collection of 3 or 4 Cajun huts. So we lived in one of these Cajun huts. There were absolutely no facilities at all. No lavatories or running water or light or anything. It was all very, very primitive there. So we set up our radio on the first day, and there was a tall tree close by. I thought, well, that tree would do fine for the aerial. So I climbed the tree, and I got some way up the tree. I felt I was being bitten, and I was horrified to find I was absolutely covered from head to toe in large red ants, all in my hair, everywhere. So I came down that tree, down sight quicker than I went up, and these ants dig their head right into the skin, so if one pulls them off, the head's left in, which is obviously not wise. And so my friend Colin went all over me with a cigarette. He put the cigarette on, and they withdrew the head. And so going through my hair, I had more hair then than I have now, was not a very pleasant experience. And I determined I wouldn't climb a tree again to attach my aerial. In future, what I did was I tied a stone on the end of the aerial, threw it up over the tree, and that was always pretty successful. So we got the radio going. We made contact with Colombo quite well. And when we were there, of course, we had to do our own cipher work. There were only the two of us, so we had to do our own cipher work, and we had to learn how to do that before we went up there. And that was quite laborious, but at least we knew the contents of the messages we were sending. And it was all concerning the drops, and the canisters, all the what was dropped in went in canisters, so they were always referred to as canisters. And any agents that were dropped in were bodies. There'd be so many bodies going tonight. But names were not mentioned. It was all in terms of bodies and canisters. So although we knew the contents, it didn't mean all that much to us. But we used to sit up all night ciphering and then ciphering all night long. We only had oil lamps. We did have a tilly lamp, but we used to spend all day trying to get it to go because the paraffin was so dirty and it was not at all successful. So most of the time we just had oil lamps. And of course it's dark at 6 o'clock out there, so the evenings are long. The RAF camp was about a mile away, and they did have a sort of cinema there which we could go to. Which we did quite often. So we were still working there when the Japanese surrender came. And following the surrender, the drops changed from sending supplies to the guerrillas to dropping supplies to the prisoner of war camps. I remember Ranto Parapat as one, Lubuk Lingo in Sumatra. I think it was Sumatra. We're notorious camps. And I have a photograph, actually, which perhaps I shouldn't have, of supplies dropping into each of those camps. And I believe it was called Operation Mastiff, the dropping of supplies to the POW camps.
Did you know anything about the conditions of the POWs in Japanese
camps? Yes. We had one man, Major Jacobs, and I believe he was a South African, and he dropped into one of the camps, and in fact it was my job to go and wake them. I had to go and wake him up, I remember, to catch the plane to go off of the drop. And he sent signals back. I have the newspaper cutting now, in a local Ceylon newspaper at the time. He described the inmates of the camp as living dead, and they weren't interested to know the war was over and they'd be going home. They lost all interest in life, poor chaps. So that work went on for a while, and then I was recalled to Colombo. And we commenced to run the station down at Colombo. The Fannies went home, and we eventually moved on to Singapore on the troop ship Devonshire, which was a great improvement on the Ranchi we'd been on before. We arrived in Singapore, and we were taken to Changi camp, which was in a pretty poor state because the POWs had moved out and we moved in. And the big concrete barrack blocks, no water, no light, just the concrete floors to sleep on. And we set up a mobile transmitting and receiving station on the edge of the airfield, which was just a very temporary strip in those days, not like the Changi airfield one reads about today. It was just a strip with the perforated metal slabs forming the airstrip. We worked on the edge there for some time. And then, of course, SOE was disbanded. But we were then called ALF PMO, Allied Land Forces Paramilitary Organization. And we continued working to our agents in Thailand and Sumatra and thereabouts. Well, then, after a short while, I was sent to Bangkok. And we went on a small cargo boat, which had a cargo of cigarettes. And we had a quite idyllic journey. After being on troop ships, this was great pleasure to be on this cargo boat where we had bunk beds. And I remember one morning during the course of the journey, we were served with hot cross buns. I didn't even know it was Easter. It was quite incredible. So that must have been Easter 46. We had this very pleasant journey. But the boat was too large to go up the river to Bangkok, so it anchored at the mouth of the river. And there were, I think, seven of us. We were told to get off onto a barge with our kit, and a tug would come to tow us up the river. So we got onto this barge at midday. Why? I really can't imagine, because it was so hot. And this barge, being all metal, reflected the heat. And we waited and waited. There was no shade whatsoever. And we all suffered quite badly. Our heads were aching. And the light reflecting off the water made it even worse. And we were stuck there until 3 a.m. Mercifully, of course, the sun had gone down by then. I was never so pleased to see the sun go down as I was that day. At 3 a.m., before that, as soon as the sun went down, the wind got up. The sea became rough, and it was really quite terrifying. There was nothing to hang on to on this barge, and we were all in great danger of being thrown overboard. It was really quite frightening. And when one thinks there must be sharks about in that water, it wasn't very enjoyable. So we were very thankful when we saw the lights on the barge approach.